Well, thank you very much, Don, and I do appreciate what you have been prepared to put on. For me, it's such short notice, and I do thank members of the club for being here to provide us with this important forum on this, my first visit here to Adelaide in the election campaign, probably my 931st since I became Leader of the Opposition. Because it is always good to be here, and it's particularly nice to be here at this final phase, if you like, of the campaigning process. To you it may seem early in the campaign, but for me, who's been going for 5 years now, this very much is the end game. And so we have all our candidates and members here in front of us, and I am looking forward to them being part of a good, forward-looking government in Canberra when we win this next election. And it's important to have a good team here from South Australia for reasons that I'll get into a bit later on in my remarks. Every time I come here, I enjoy the city. The vistas of the hills, coastline, the glorious light, the most beautiful architecture. But most of all, I think it's the big dose of tenacity in South Australians that makes this such a great place. Whatever the odds, people here prove over and over again that they can set the bar high, then grit their teeth and get over it. My old mate and prominent South Australian, Mick Young, rose from shearer to one of the most senior members of the Hawke Cabinet. Mick was the sort of bloke who wouldn't have seen that as a big change of status. And I guess it was in Mick that I first identified the true South Australian spirit. I've seen it over and again since then, in film director Scott Hicks, astronaut Andy Thomas, in lawyer, judge and state governor Dame Roma Mitchell. They all set new benchmarks, just as Stuart O'Grady has ridden all his way into the history books of world cycling. I recall being upstaged by the O'Grady family on a visit to Adelaide back in 1998. We pulled up in front of the ABC and there was a media pack there, so I did up my jacket and prepared myself for a doorstop. And as I opened my mouth to speak, I caught the tail end of the pack as they rounded on my driver, Brian O'Grady, who just happens to be Stuart's dad. The night before this, Stuart had become only the second Australian to wear the leader's yellow jersey in the Tour de France, and everybody wanted a word with the proud dad. Well, Stuart, Andy, Dame Roma and Scott are the ones who get the headlines. But there are thousands of other South Australians who receive little recognition for the good work they do. And I'd particularly like to welcome today the ANZAC workers who are here with us. I think they're sitting with Steve Georgianis. Yeah, here we are. Yes, ANZAC workers are here with us. They made ANZAC one of the world's great airlines. And unlike the Howard government, I won't rest until they're in the air again. I flew to ANZAC today on a chartered to Adelaide today on a chartered ANZAC plane with ANZAC staff, which is more than interstate tourists and the people of South Australia can do. John Howard didn't think to put Adelaide on the map as far as ANZAC Mark II was concerned. The airline is flying between Sydney, Melbourne, Perth and Brisbane, but not Adelaide. But I guess after 5.5 years of a Howard government and 8 years of a state Liberal government, South Australians are used to missing out. After years of neglect by Liberal governments, South Australians face a serious choice at this election about their security, about their future. And I think South Australians deserve a special plan for recovery, and I'll come to that in a minute. But first you should know that people all over this country are fed up with the way the Howard government only seems to look after the better off in the community. Whether it's the decline of our public hospitals and schools, or the disparity in living standards between country and city, or whether it's the way the GST has attacked so many small businesses, this government has nothing to offer people in financial difficulties. In these insecure times, what we need is a government that offers us security at home as well as security abroad. Now, as you have heard me, if you bothered to watch last night, I think I have good security credentials. having been Defence Minister for 5 years and a member of the Security Cabinet of this country for 11 years. And I put the Defence Forces in the good shape that they are in today, and I have a much better plan than my opponent for ensuring border protection in this country. The Howard Government has ignored the real security needs of Australians, particularly as regards their jobs, their health and their education. And no one knows this better than people here. This state's economic performance has, generally speaking, found it in more difficulty than the rest of the states in the Australian economy. The rate of job creation here has been well below the national average, and most of the extra jobs have been part-time. But in spite of all of this, the Howard Government has never recognised the special needs of the state. Well, the party I lead, the Australian Labor Party, has a plan to help get the state back on its feet. And I'm here today to pledge that a Beazley Labor Government will mend the damage done by John Howard and John Olsen. I am pleased to announce today that we plan to spend an extra $65 million over 4 years on a package of measures to build on this state's undoubted strengths and to put you in a position to take advantage of the new opportunities of the 21st century. Most importantly, we will tackle the crisis in this state's power supply with a $20 million grant, a move critical to securing lower power prices for your businesses and security of supply to your households. As well, we will nurse back to health South Australia's public hospitals that have been allowed to decay alarmingly under the Liberals. We will create industry and job opportunities through a range of measures, including the establishment of an Institute of Manufacturing and in assistance to the defence, fisheries and wine industries, along with the revitalisation of regional centres. And we'll do much more to improve the environment. I can promise today a Labor government will ban nuclear dumps in this state. Today I'm also proud to announce details of Labor's plan to tackle salinity, which will involve additional spending around this country of some $169 million. And that will come on top of a better targeting of the National Heritage funding of some $469 million. That National Heritage program has received some pretty awful reviews by those who have looked independently at how it's operated to this point. It has been bitsy. It has not been outcome-based in ensuring the funding, and it's been intensely political. The time has come to channel it into proven programs that deal with the sorts of salinity issues, water quality issues, environmental issues, which so deeply impact on the lives of our people and impact on where we are headed in the future. And I can promise you that we will not rest until we have improved the water quality of our great national resource, the River Murray. Labor has listened to what South Australians are telling us. The Labor Party's South Australian package, which I present to you today, has been carefully developed between the state Labor team, led by Mike Rann, and our very able federal candidates. Labor knows that people want to feel secure about their future and the future of their children. Labor's plan to make Australia a knowledge nation means developing our existing industries as well as nurturing the industries of the future. This is how we will secure the high-wage, high-skilled jobs the people of this state deserve for themselves and their families. You all know that South Australia and its electricity supply problems have caused nothing less than a crisis for this state's economy. Liberals are getting a bit desperate in this state, I've got to say. Don't know what you've done to the mic, but it's something pretty horrible. John Olsen's, it must be this, John Olsen's bungled privatisation deal, and John Howard's GST has left South Australian businesses and families with an expensive and unreliable power supply. In recent years, South Australians have sweated through summers with frequent blackouts. Given the state's heavy reliance on electricity-intensive industries, South Australia's unreliable electricity supply is the most significant barrier to improving the state's economy. Businesses here have faced massive price increases, and their electricity bills are undermining their economic competitiveness. From 2003, every house in this state could face the same skyrocketing power bills. John Howard's GST has made the impact of electricity prices on the family budget and on the business bottom line even worse. The Howard government believes that we should simply leave the power supply to the free market. We disagree. A Beazley government will provide a capital grant of up to $20 million to support the development of an electricity interconnector between South Australia and New South Wales or Victoria. These funds may be used for the augmentation of the gas supply if that is proved to be more useful. When I talk to South Australian industry, they tell me that the power crisis is the state's greatest immediate economic challenge. So today I'm putting Labor's solution on the table. The people of this state and the future of the once strong manufacturing industries here demand no less. A Labor government will also redress the squeeze put on the South Australian health services by Howard and Olsen. South Australians will benefit from many of our additional health plans, such as our recently announced $100 million scheme for dental health care for low-income earners. South Australia would be entitled to up to $7.2 million under this scheme. While the Liberal governments blame each other for the deplorable state of public health, a Federal Labor government will work with a RAN state government to provide real funding growth for South Australia's hard-pressed hospital system. More details of Labor's Medicare alliance will be released later in the campaign, but I can reveal today, with a great deal of pride, some major commitments, major projects that will be funded as part of Labor's commitment to South Australia. A Labor government will provide $15 million to accelerate the second and third stages of the Queen Elizabeth Hospital redevelopment. Another hospital with a long and proud tradition of serving the South Australian community is the Royal Adelaide. At the RAH, Labor will spend $8 million on cancer treatment services with the replacement of two radiotherapy machines and the provision of additional staff. We'll also provide extra funding to reduce hospital waiting lists. And Labor will establish an independent inquiry to investigate the contract and operations of the privatised Modbury Hospital. This privatisation appears to show that the Olsen state government has the same blinkered ideological approach to healthcare as the Howard government. Well, we in the Labor Party think your Medicare card should be more important than your credit card, and that is the attitude that will govern all our healthcare policies in government. Now, turning from health to our environment, while I've said repeatedly that the Howard government gives South Australia nothing, there are two things John Howard and his South Australian-based federal colleagues are determined to give this state. They are nuclear dumps, where the nation's radioactive waste will be deposited, and the polluted, salty remnants of the once mighty Murray. Now, last time I addressed the press club, I outlined my plans to resolve the vital national issue of managing the River Murray. I explained salinity, land degradation and declining water quality were costing Australians billions of dollars each year, and South Australia was at the rough end of a national and systemic crisis. Well, more than a year later, there's been no improvement. Already in South Australia, all agricultural districts exhibit some degree of salinity, and a word of warning for those who drink the water from the Murray: in 20 years' time, that water will not pass World Health Organisation standards on 2 days out of five. Well, I now commit a Federal Labor government to spending $169 million extra fighting salinity with incentives to stop land clearing in the areas affecting the Murray River. The Murray's predicament is not generated in South Australia alone, nor it can be solved here in isolation. The impact of unsustainable land practices are often realised at the great distances from their origin. We will address land clearing because it is a major cause of salinity, land degradation and loss of biodiversity. We will assist the states in implementing clearing controls to reverse decline in quality and extent of native vegetation. Within the first 150 days of coming to office, I will convene a meeting of the Council of Australian Governments to address salinity as a matter of priority. A national strategy will be coordinated by a new Office of Sustainable Development within the Prime Minister's Department and will be driven through COAC. Land managers are the stewards of our landscapes and will necessarily play a critical role in maintaining and protecting our natural environment. While today's landholders are more environmentally conscious than ever before, and in many areas they are leading the world in environmental management, the status quo is not sustainable. It is the role of governments to assist and encourage landholders to move towards more sustainable practices through education, provision of incentives, and implementation of minimum standards. Governments and the broader community must recognise the environmental services that landholders provide, and where property rights are affected, we must provide due compensation. The Howard Government, which has done nothing to solve the salinity situation, has been active in other areas. It has scoured Australia looking for a place to dump the country's nuclear waste. South Australian Senator Nick Minchin headed the scouting mission and found a number of preferred sites, all, funnily enough, in his home state. Now, Labor recognises that South Australia has had its fair share of unsafe and ill-considered nuclear experiments at places like Maralinga and Emu. We have listened to the overwhelming opposition of the people of South Australia and decided this state is not the place for a nuclear dump. If on November the 10th you can't decide on which party to vote for, think of this. A Liberal government will dump nuclear waste in your great state and the Labor government won't. The serious economic challenges facing the state demand action from the federal government. As I've already stated, the great immediate challenge is to secure South Australia's power supplies. But there are also long-term commitments that must be made at the national level if South Australia is to set itself up for future growth. South Australia has a number of industrial strengths, and we all know what they are. Manufacturing, defence industry, wine industry, agriculture and fisheries. The future of these industries and the future jobs of South Australians is at risk unless we look ahead and show some real commitment to these industries. My government will spend almost $9 million over 4 years to establish the Australian Institute of Manufacturing. The Institute will be the focal point of a network of people with skills in policy, strategy, finance, operations, technology, education and research. The Institute of Manufacturing will support emerging and established manufacturing industries by aiding them in all aspects of their business, as well, in a measure aimed at supporting this state's manufacturing industries. Labor will review the level and nature of assistance for the textile, clothing and footwear and automotive industries. And we will do it before, not after, the current arrangements expire in 2004. South Australia's manufacturing industries have told us they are worried about the effect of tariff reductions. But the Howard Government says it will only review tariffs after the changes have been introduced. That's a bit like saying you'll think about getting ants set up in the air after you've stood by and watched it collapse. 17,000 ANZUS workers found themselves without jobs and without their entitlements when the airline was grounded last month. Tens of thousands more jobs were lost in related industries. By conducting a review of tariff reductions before they take place, we will be able to look at the possible outcomes and act accordingly. We will act in the interest of thousands of South Australian workers and the many companies that would be affected by tariff reductions. The Howard Government wants to sit back and see what happens to these industries and the workers. Well, we think workers and their families are too important for this hands-off approach. In 1987, I had the very great pleasure as Defence Minister of coming to South Australia to announce that the Collins-class submarines would be built here in Adelaide. In the past couple of years, we have seen a substantial loss of highly skilled jobs from the Australian Submarine Corporation. These losses included highly skilled production workers and top-level engineering, design and other staff. South Australia has unique defence industry capabilities, and Labor will build on these local strengths. We will support existing and new defence industry firms to create jobs and develop new industries in South Australia through the creation of a $7.5 million defence industry cluster. The role of the cluster will be to secure orders and jobs for the Australian Submarine Corporation workforce and promote the development of existing and start-up firms linked to the ASC, particularly in the areas of advanced engineering and electronics. Now, while Adelaide plays a dominant role in the South Australian economy, we believe it is vital for the welfare of the state and the nation to promote and encourage development in regional centres. Two of the major industries that create wealth and employment outside the cities are the wine industry and commercial fishing. The commercial sector of the fishing industry is now Australia's fourth most valuable food-based primary industry, after beef, wheat and milk. South Australia has the widest range of fishing-related activities in Australia, leading the way at sea and with land-based aquaculture. We will spend more than $4 million over 4 years further developing the Australian Fisheries Academy at Port Adelaide. It will promote the Academy as a national resource for training and research in the seafood industry. One of South Australia's most successful and definitely most enjoyable products has already earned this state and the country many millions of export dollars. And I take this opportunity to congratulate those in the wine industry on their marketing, their innovation and most importantly their product. Well, South Australia is home to around half this nation's wine industry, and what a great industry it is. We will assist small wineries to resist the pressure that has been placed on them by the tax changes implemented by the Howard government by exempting them from the wine equalisation tax. This will help the wine industry in South Australia to maintain the individuality of the many wine producers and regions for which South Australia is internationally renowned. One of the great weaknesses of the Howard government has been its refusal to believe in regional development. The time is long overdue to get the issue of regional disadvantage onto the national agenda. We are all aware of the tests of rural life, but major regional centres such as Port Pirie, Port Augusta and Whyalla also face serious economic and social challenges. In recent times, unemployment in these areas has never dipped below double digits. Their future has been further threatened by the recent series of corporate collapses and uncertain future for companies such as Pasminco. While Labor's regional development policy is still to be released, I can say that Labor will actively support regional South Australia. The Howard government held a forum for the Upper Spencer Gulf a few years back, but failed to back it up with a financial commitment. Labor has never supported the Howard government's hands-off approach to regional development, and I announce today that the Upper Spencer Gulf region will be one of the first regions supported by Labor. Labor also recognises that disadvantage is about more than a country-city divide. The challenges facing suburbs in Adelaide's north are just as entrenched. These communities have also missed out on a fair share of opportunities and jobs under the Howard government. These families were once the battlers John Howard claimed he would help. The only help he gave these people was a great big 10% GST and a cut in vital health, education and employment services. Well, I won't stand for that. My government will work with state and local governments to create job opportunities and restore confidence in these communities. A strong Adelaide and strong regions makes a stronger South Australia, and a stronger South Australia makes a stronger nation. And I want to assure you that one of the reasons why I am so absolutely determined that we should get ANZAC Mark II up and flying again is not simply because of the fact that every one of us would want to see these good people back in their jobs. But you're like me in that you're distant from where you live, from the main centres of economic power in this country. I'm from Perth, you're here in Adelaide. We know this absolutely. If we are not served by two full-blown, competent airlines, we are in diabolical trouble. Diabolical trouble. We cannot afford to see this persist, so I'll again urge Mr. Howard to take a generous sit down with the administrator. Don't just take a generous view. Sit down with the administrator. We now know that there are serious players prepared to get an Ansett Mark II up and running. Just as the federal government strewed tax in the way of, albeit a very bad management team for Ansett Mark I before Ansett collapsed, they nevertheless presented some serious options for their rescue, which were quite deliberately ignored. Since then, there's been this hands-off approach to the administrator, who has been struggling manfully to get Ansett up and operating again. Well, the federal government should take every step, including contemplation of either loans or ensuring that they don't make claims upon the resources that are actually going into the airline, so that the airline can get up and running again. I believe they must do it now. I've said I'll do it in 4 weeks' time if I'm Prime Minister. That's too long. It has to be done now. And if there are problems associated with a caretaker role, then I'm prepared to give comfort to the Prime Minister on those matters, should he choose to act. Because while it is important for the jobs of the people who work for Ansett, important for the jobs of those many industries that supplied Ansett, for people in Adelaide and people in Perth and people in Townsville and Cairns, it is a lifeline and it cannot be allowed to sink. And strong regions makes a stronger South Australia. And a strong South Australia makes a strong nation. And that's why a Beazley Labor government will establish this special package for this great state. That's not something you'll see from John Howard. Before I finish today, I'd like to ask the Federal Labor team from South Australia to stand. There they are. Now these... These men and women are dedicated to the future of South Australia. In developing Labor's South Australian package, they have worked hard to focus on the state's strengths and position it to take advantage of new opportunities. These are the people we need fighting for the interests of South Australia in our national government in Canberra. And we in the Labor Party believe in a brighter future for this state, but we know that it will take a special commitment to ensure that South Australians get a fair deal in their jobs, health and living standards. Our only Labor has that commitment, and a Beazley Labor government will make sure the job is done. A secure future for all Australians, that's what we stand for. Thanks very much. Well, on your team.
And now questions from the media. I'd ask you to give your name and the organisation you represent before you ask your question, and come please to this one central microphone. Local media first, if we could.
There's a question over here, eh? Oh, that's right.
Come, local media, flood to the... please.
There's somebody over here.
Electricity privatisation, and I wish I could see my notes, and deregulation of the banks, the airline industry, and the dairy industry. Absolutely fabulous in theory, pretty bloody lousy in practice. You've already mentioned the electricity industry. What are you going to do about the re-regulating, or at least partly re-regulating, the banks, and the airlines and these other industries on behalf of a long-suffering Australian public?
Let me get on the... Well, thank you very much for that question, which I think would be clear to all. We have made absolutely clear this about the banks. They have a job servicing the Australian public. They have social responsibilities. They have been the enormous beneficiaries over the years of decisions taken by employers and accepted by workers to pay wages through the banks, likewise in relation to the receipt of pensions, social security benefits and the like. The banks have benefited massively from that, and they owe the community. They owe the community. Now, what that means, to our mind, is that they've got to sign up to a social charter. We've said that they can sign up voluntarily, and if they don't, we'll do it legislatively. Frankly, I think we'll be doing it legislatively. What I think we need in that social charter, it should contain a number of elements. But the key elements would be this. Fee-free services for pensioners, frill-free and some fee-free, low frills and some fee-free services for families, an obligation that when a service is going to be shut down in a particular area, it carries with it a six-month notice and the renegotiation by the banks of a replacement service. Now, there are other things that we think that ought to be placed in that social charter as well, that goes to the education of those who utilise the banking services and other consumer protection devices. But those are the three key elements. We think if we do that, we'll build some community confidence back into the notion that the banks serve them.
Wendy Glemacek from ABC News. Obviously you've cancelled out the option of a medium-level, high-level waste dump built in South Australia. The three-headed kangaroo out the front reminds me to ask you which state under a Labor government would get a higher-level waste dump.
I don't think it needs to be a determination made any time soon. The technologies dealing with that are advancing, and I don't think you need to make up your mind on that in the next parliament at all. But suffice it to say, we'll put the matter to study. The point here is this. You've got to share burdens around the country. And the one place which already carries the substantial nuclear burden is here, and therefore it should not be put here.
Leonie Mellor, Channel 10. Actually, I was going along the same lines as that. But so you would prefer to keep the South Australia's nuclear waste in the 20 or so sites that it's already housed in before going ahead with another study?
Before you go and set up a substantial new dump. And I don't think that we're under urgent pressure at this point at all to finalise that. But I do think I'm under urgent pressure, given what has occurred so far, to determine whether or not I'm going to deal with this on an equitable basis. And if I'm going to deal with it on an equitable basis, it doesn't come here.
Susie O'Brien from The Advertiser. What happens to the Medicare Alliance if a state Labor government doesn't get elected?
Well, it would be better if a state Labor government was, because Mike Rann is signed up to it. But I don't operate on the assumption that I act punitively with state Liberal governments. I have a view about the states which is a bit different from most Commonwealth Prime Ministers or would-be Prime Ministers. I suppose it comes from actually representing a small state. And we haven't had one of those since World War II. Barry Jones pointed out to me that before World War II, roughly one-third of Australian Prime Ministers came from small states, one-third came from New South Wales, and one-third came from Victoria. Since World War II, there have been exclusively from New South Wales and Victoria. So certain perspectives have prevailed at the Commonwealth level. I think I'll be the first since World War II who's not in that category. everything I want to do that means anything at all, be it in health, be it in education, be it in the environment, be it in regional development. I assume that I must do it in partnership with the states. I've had experience of that before as a minister when I was the Education and Training Minister and signed up a Australian National Training Authority. The Commonwealth subsequently welched on the deal that I put in place in that regard, but I had to deal with Liberal and Labor states to do it, and we succeeded in doing it. I do think it would be easier to do it with a state Labor government that was absolutely determined that real growth would occur in health spending. The experience of state Liberal governments over the course of the last few years puts a big question mark over that. But the performance of state Labor governments since then hasn't. And so I think for a secure, effective Medicare alliance, it would be better to have Mike Rann there than John Olsen. But if Olsen came along to me and said, hey, I want to be in it, and he happened to be the Premier of South Australia, I wouldn't spurn him. It's not about politics in the end, it's about people.
Colin James from the Advertiser. Mr. Beasley, just after a bit of clarification about your plan to save us from our impending power crisis, with your $20 million package, I know that it's only for 1 year of expenditure. What expenditure do you have for the medium to long term on solving our electricity crisis? And how can you guarantee that the $20 million that you've earmarked so far, if you opt for the Riverlink connection, will not end up in New South Wales?
Well, because I'm offering it here for a resolution here. It is unclear as to whether or not this would be required for the interconnection in relation to electricity, which is why, or whether all of it is needed for that purpose, which is why I've left flexibility for maybe doing it on gas as well, and why I've left flexibility as to which part of the grid you access. That is not clear from current affairs here in South Australia. But I am told that $20 million would be a big help as South Australia sits down and contemplates how they connect with the eastern states grid. If you're going to be able to avoid those blackouts and get a decent priced electricity product here, you simply must do that. And I think that's acknowledged here. But you might need a bit of assistance to get there. And hence that undertaking. Now, if problems are not resolved, then you want to come back and talk to us again, that's fine. But we think that this will do the trick, and we are operating in a pretty sparse budget climate at the moment, so all the promises that we make are carefully calibrated to being the absolutely deliverable.
The national media, have you questions?
Dennis Atkins from the Brisbane Courier Mail, Mr. Beasley. A couple of years ago, you told us that we should get used to your prolix ways. After the debate last night, should we now take that as a non-core promise?
Yeah, I've broken that one. Thanks, Dennis. Right.
Mari Barton from the West Australian newspaper. Mr. Beasley, today you've announced a $7.65 million package to boost the defence industry in South Australia. This would be in direct competition with WA. I'm just wondering, are you turning your back on WA, or are there some further announcements that we should know about?
I think it's very important that we don't in this country, and one of the reasons why I want alliances with state premiers, that we don't run beggar thy neighbour policies and assume that something happens here means that something else doesn't happen elsewhere. There is a difference between the defence industries in South Australia and the defence industries in Western Australia. Defence industry in West Australia is heavily around, almost exclusively around shipbuilding. In South Australia, it's heavily electronics oriented. They aren't, except for the question of the submarine, major submarine upgrade, about which I've already made remarks in the past. They're not really in competition. the focus in West Australia is not the same focus as here in South Australia. But there is a problem here in South Australia. When we put in place the submarine project, we massively changed the capabilities of South Australian industry and utilised an enormous amount of work that had gone on from what was produced from the big defence scientific establishment here, which exists here but not in West Australia, and the various aviation and electronics elements of defence industry which exists here and not in Western Australia. But now all of that would be well enhanced in the national interest by ensuring that we could develop from it approaches to work opportunities which are currently being lost. Some of that, of course, which would relate to the equipment budget, the equipment vote of the Department of Defence here in Australia, but much of it would also relate to civilian opportunities. So this particular cluster, I think, has very little to do with anything that's going on in any other states in the nation, but everything to do with the national interest.
Mr. Beasley, David Heath from 3AW in Melbourne. Apparently there's been a deal struck this afternoon between the ANSET administrator and the government on the $150 million from New Zealand, $50 million for worker entitlements and $100 million to get the planes back in the sky. What are your thoughts on that proposal?
As I heard, it was $100 million to get the planes back in the sky, $35 million for workers entitlements and $15 million for something else. I'm not quite sure what that was. But I've said to the government before that they should, on the money that comes into ANSET, they should minimise their claims from it for the workers' entitlements. You see, what the government is currently doing in relation to the workers' entitlements is putting in place a ticket tax, and then they're going to replenish the government's coffers from what it is that they managed to get out of ANSET after paying over the product of that ticket tax and then using that money for other purposes. Now, I think what they ought to be motivated for by more than that is, in the first instance, getting ANSET up and flying again. They've got that ticket tax to cover at least what they define as the necessary workers' entitlements. What they should be preoccupied with now is getting in the air as much of ANSET as they possibly can, minimising upon themselves the issue of workers' entitlements by virtue of the fact that the workers are back at work, and some deal can be negotiated on that front for entitlements for workers who are back at work. It's this mixed motives here. The government started, I think, with a view that accepted theoretically that Australia could only contain one major airline. It then moved from that view to the view that if Singapore Airlines was allowed to acquire a controlling stake in ANSET, then somehow or other the Australian airline Qantas would be disadvantaged, and therefore that particular solution to ANSET's problems ought not to be permitted. They ignored the fact that about the only people in the country who really know that ANSET's foreign-owned is the government and the financial commentators in the newspapers. Most Australians think it's an Aussie company for the simple reason that it employs thousands of Australians. And it was Australian jobs that should have been their focus, not their view about the ownership status of ANSET. And then they've moved from that to the view that nothing is possible to save ANSET and the best thing to do is to smooth the dying pillow as quickly as possible. And they're now gradually being dragged off that view, to perhaps because they now see, obviously, that some people are seriously interested, they'll think about doing something. Well, all that they decided today, frankly, was marking time. What they've got to do is to take a more generous view, sit down with that administrator and regard themselves as part of the solution, not just sitting on the outskirts waiting to see what others will do and chipping away for themselves at one or two of the resources that become available.
Annabelle Crabb from The Age, feeling very short. Mr. Beasley, in your policy document that you put out today on salinity, you've accused John Howard of believing that water and natural resource management as a state and territory issue. Is that a signal that Beazley government would ride in and take it over?
I think the I think it is a national responsibility. I think at the moment that Murray-Darling operation is conducted essentially in a collection of interstate bureaucracies, and it's got to change its character. The interstate component of it has to be shifted into the political sphere, the Council of Australian Governments. And the Commission itself needs to be a stakeholders stroke scientific expertise stroke consumers type body to advise what is essentially a coalition of Australian governments on dealing with those problems. If you elevate it to that level, I believe, and have the Commonwealth component operated out of the Prime Minister's Department, the Office of Sustainable Development that I mentioned here, what you're going to be able to do is to get the level of financial support and national coordination that starts to deal with some of the problems that you've had on land clearance to this point. You'll notice that there's a certain amount in here related to it about issues and targets and caps associated with that land clearance. That's going to require incentives, and the money is there for those incentives. It's going to require the Commonwealth effectively to give the states the capacity to resist the massive pressures that there are there for land clearance. The states cannot really do it on their own. They're not resourced enough. And they can't operate in the long term enough just simply on the basis of their interstate cooperation. It has to be elevated to a national responsibility. My belief is that COAG should meet at least twice a year, and that permanently on the COAG agenda should be this issue. There are three others I want on the COAG agenda as well, but this one. So every time we meet, in other words, every 6 months, there is a discussion between the states and the Commonwealth at Premier Prime Minister level about what is happening to the salinity issues, water quality issues in the river system.
Mr. Beazley, Sarah Clark, ABC TV. If you win government in 4 weeks, would you include Cheryl Curnow in your cabinet, number one? And number two, have you spoken to her in the last couple of days to encourage her to detail her stamp duty concessions, particularly to the public?
She would be Minister for Employment, were I elected to office, and that is a cabinet position. That's the first point. The second point is she's entitled to defend herself on these matters. She's made her position clear, and she is arguing her case, I think well, under what has been a continued and repeated assaults from the Liberals. She's getting on with defending herself on that, and I'm getting on with running the election campaign.
Are there any other questions from the media?
Yes, there are. It's a flood.
Susie O'Brien from the Advertiser. Glad that Annabel Crabb brought the microphone down to my level. What was your position in Federal Cabinet when the national electricity market was discussed some years ago, given that it's been such a problem for South Australians?
Decisions taken in relation to South Australia, I believe, have been taken by South Australians. The decision effectively to exclude the federal grid, as I understand, or national grid, as I understand, is a South Australian decision. This was not one mandated by any national agreement. It was a decision, I believe, taken by the Olson government, largely related to the price they expected to have returned to them of the sale of the asset. So it's not a position that has been mandated by anything I was discussing at the time when I was in the cabinet. Was I a member of the Cabinet when we discussed the issues of the national electricity policy? I certainly was. One of the reasons why we arrived at the conclusions we did was that we discovered, to our surprise, a greater level of collaboration between East and West Germany when they marked the marking line of the Cold War and were faced with, I think on the one side, about 40 Soviet divisions all ready to charge down the Fulda Gap, and about 30 American divisions prepared to go the other way, and with tactical nukes ready to throw at each other in case one or other lost, they still managed to do better on cooperation on the electricity market than we did between New South Wales and Victoria, which says, says something about the history of our people as a nation. So we decided that we should try to get a situation where there was an opportunity for people to benefit from each of the state electricity markets being able to get into another. It seems to me that the problems in South Australia have been caused not so much by that policy, but by the unwillingness of the South Australian government to allow, until this point, an access to the rest of the grid in order to enhance the performance, or at least the economic viability or profitability or whatever, of the South Australian company. Now that's a mistake, and that mistake is being dealt with and will have to be dealt with, and we want to help the dealing with it.
Mr. Beasley, Rani Sadler, 7 News. What's your reaction to the spate of supposed anthrax attacks which are causing chaos across Australia today?
I don't believe there are any anthrax attacks in Australia. The reports that we had last night of problems at the airport in Sydney proved not to be the case, and there have been a number of false reports. That's not the case in the United States, of course, where they do have a number of verified reports. I notice the FBI in the United States is saying that they're not necessarily yet connecting that with any other events internationally, but there is clearly a problem building up. I think that on the issues of international terrorism, we require new levels of vigilance. New levels of vigilance that mean that we have better information than we have now and a better capacity to respond, which is why I've suggested we have to restore to the Federal Police a counter-terrorist unit. We have to create a new Federal Protective Service under the Federal Police. And that Federal Protective Service, while focused basically on vital installations, would have within their training capabilities the capacity to operate as sky marshals when a threat emerges in that area. They would also be responsible for the coordination and management of airport security and setting the standards of airport guards. These are some of the measures that we'd need to take to upgrade our capacity to respond to any sort of threat, including that of what we might experience, what it may be being experienced elsewhere in relation to biological threats, and which seems at the moment not to be being experienced here. But the world's a different place now. We have to get to grips with this international terrorist threat and defeat it. Blair and Bush are right on that, and we have to help them, even though there are enormous international difficulties created as they go about dealing with it. This is not a threat that's going to go away unless it's forced away. And while that is being done, we require levels of vigilance here in this country we've never conceived.
Mr. Beasley, Dennis Atkins again. In your speech today, you said that you would, a Beasley government would establish an Australian Institute of Manufacturing and an Australian Fisheries Academy, as well as setting up a defence industry cluster. And you've said that there will be a greater, much greater role for COAG if Labor was elected. How would you respond to criticism that this kind of approach is going to produce a lot more bureaucracy and a lot more bureaucratic process and not be outcome driven?
There are about four different things there. The Fisheries Academy already exists, and it would be enhancing that. That's research and training rather than bureaucracy. A similar thing would apply in relation to the Manufacturing Institute, that is to research capabilities in management, in technologies, in enhancing our ability as a manufacturing centre, as a nation. These are not really bureaucracies, they're more research and training institutes. In relation to COAG, a bureaucracy already exists in regard to the river system. The bureaucracy is already there. The question is the bureaucracy operating, albeit with very good people, very good public service, at the sort of lowest common denominator basis that you get from what is essentially an interstate cooperative body, or is it operating on the basis of what is the right solutions and how do we get the right solutions? I think by lifting it to COAG, you de-bureaucratise it. You put it in the hands of the political leadership who are driven by people like yourself to be outcomes-based. And then you put the Commission itself in the hands of people who can produce outcomes or have a direct interest in producing outcomes, like stakeholders and scientists. I think my answer to you, Dennis, would be that this de-bureaucratises. Now I'm getting prolix. But anyway, I can't think of another word to say about it at this stage. That would de-bureaucratise the process rather than enhancing that. I think the more we state and federal governments get together at the political level with an agenda that is known publicly and which there are known failings and weaknesses in our society, the more we will all find our state and federal political agendas driven by what people really need rather than by what we manage to conceal.
This is the last question. Last question. Last one.
Mr. Beasley, Kathy Lipari, Daily Telegraph. There are a number of important issues that you pointed out weren't discussed in Sunday night's debate: health, aged care, the environment. Mr. Howard has indicated he doesn't think he's going to change his mind on holding a second debate. Is there anything you can do to change his mind?
Yes, I can put the weights on him. I mean, the point is this. I at least have the bulk for that. The point is this. The Australian people deserve an explanation. The invigilator in this particular case pointed out that we had not covered critical matters as far as Australian people were concerned. Ray Martin correctly identified there'd been no discussion of health, there'd been no discussion of the environment, there'd been no discussion of aged care. We have an incomplete national debate. There is an absolute obligation on politicians in a campaign to do that. Now, if I'm elected Prime Minister, I'll test myself at least twice. And the second of those tests will be closer to election day. My preference at this point, and give or take a day or two, it would be in the final weekend before the vote. And that's when I think all your policies are out there on the table. If you've got the courage of your convictions, you can debate them. If you've got belief in your direction, you can debate it. I can only assume that Mr. Howard won't debate because he cannot see beyond his retirement. And this election campaign is being fought around what is the bare minimum necessary to be done on every policy front to get him over the next few months, as opposed to this nation over the next decade. And that is the principal difference between us. Now, if that is not true, then Mr. Howard has another opportunity to demonstrate that point. He can come and meet us in another debate. If he is not going to do it, he's merely running away.
So nuclear dust, salinity, power, hospitals, Institute of Manufacturing, defence, fish, the regions, and... the wet tax. I suspect Orlando Windham is beyond the size to make it eligible. However, we have a bottle of a Magnum of 1993 St. Hugo Coonawarra Cabernet Sauvignon.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that Orlando is beyond the wet tax, so therefore I can safely accept this gift.
Thanks very much. Would you say thank you in the normal way, please?